Seeking mental health care can be overwhelming and even scary, but it doesn't have to be. I'm Dr. Josephine McNary, and I'm committed to making this process easier for you. Each week, my expert guest and I unravel a different form of therapeutic intervention in order to bring comfort and understanding and to help you get back to your true self. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Mind Stories. Today, I have the pleasure to talk with Dr. Erin Margolis. Dr. Margolis is a licensed clinical psychologist who works with both individuals and couples at Thrive Psychology Group in Santa Monica. She earned her master's in social work at Columbia University and her PsyD at the PGSP Stanford PsyD Consortium. She has extensive training in mental health and wellness with specialties in depression and anxiety-related disorders, relationship issues, trauma, exploration of sexual and gender identity, and life transitions. She also has a background in health psychology with a focus on the mind-body connection, managing chronic medical and health conditions, and the bidirectional relationship between physical and mental health. She has extensive training in many evidence-based practices and completed a fellowship in mindfulness and MBSR. She uses an integrated approach, pulling from various modalities in a way that is tailored to the needs of each unique client. Welcome, Erin.
Hello, thank you for joining us. Today we have Erin Margolis here, a clinical psychologist at Thrive Psychology in Santa Monica. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, of course. I'm glad to be here.
So I know you have many specialties, but one of the specialties that you have is mindfulness, as well as work with mindfulness-based stress reduction. And so it'd be great to just hear a little bit about how you incorporate that into your practice and what that means.
Yeah, well, for people who don't know, I'm sure many people do, but I'll just kind of give like a quick definition of what that actually means so that when I talk about how I use it, it might make more sense. But mindfulness is just one of many forms of meditation. And the kind of most common definition of it is the Jon Kabat-Zinn definition, which a lot of people have probably heard, which is just that mindfulness is the awareness that arises by paying attention in a particular way on purpose in the present moment without judgment, which is really a mouthful and just more simply put means noticing or paying attention, being aware, and not getting too kind of caught up or carried away by what you're noticing. And it really teaches you kind of how to be an observer of your experience. And MBSR specifically is kind of the gold standard these days for learning what mindfulness meditation is. It's probably the best researched mindfulness program out there. And whereas just a mindfulness practice is a little bit more free-flowing and unstructured, MBSR specifically is a formalized 8-week course of training in mindfulness. It's typically conducted in a group. It can be used individually. And it's once a week plus a 5 or 7 hour retreat, depending on where you do it, somewhere in there, with the expectation that people will be practicing on their own every day between classes, because mindfulness kind of has that dosing effect, just like taking an antibiotic. You got to take the full course, and the more you take, the more effective it is. And it was originally created to treat chronic pain, but when they were studying MBSR specifically, they found all sorts of changes in neurobiology and brain pathways and tons of other benefits. So the way that I use it in my practice looks a little bit different depending on the person. So first of all, if I can do it in a group, that's very different than if I can do it individually. If I do it in a group, it tends to be the more structured, formal MBSR protocol. And the nice thing about doing it in a group is it's got that common humanity element. You really realize that you are not the only one suffering. People feel really isolated in their suffering a lot of the time and tend to feel like they're the only one going through their, you know, human experience, but really we all suffer in different ways. And so doing it in a group kind of facilitates that really nice connectedness of people experiencing the same thing. When I do it in individual therapy, it can look a little different depending on the person. So some people want to integrate a formal practice into their treatment. In which case it might be 10 or 20 minutes at the beginning of each session doing a different practice from the MBSR manual or just different kind of versions of mindfulness practices. And they really build on each other week to week. So the first week we might start with a simple grounding practice or just noticing the breath, something more concrete. Again, that awareness of the current experience. And then over time, open it up more and more and more. Other people, oh, sorry, do you want to?
No, I guess a quick question I had is how would someone choose between a group versus individual?
So I think that people are just naturally drawn to one or the other. I have so many people who say, I don't want to be in a group. I don't want to share my experiences publicly. I don't want to, whether they have a lot of shame or a lot of trauma. So I worked at the VA for several years, and which is actually where I was trained in MBSR. And I had a lot of veterans who with horrible PTSD, and they just didn't want to be in a room with a bunch of other guys. Or they felt more safe and comfortable in a room with a bunch of other guys. So they preferred a group. They felt like it actually was de-shaming or helped kind of destigmatize what they were experiencing to be in a group. So it really just depends on the person's comfort. I also think in certain settings, there are only certain things available. Like for example, at the VA, there was only an MBSR group available. So there wasn't a lot of clinicians would integrate that into their integrate mindfulness into individual treatment, but the MBSR group was what was advertised. So a lot of people might come to it that way and then filter out into individual or ask their individual clinicians to integrate it into their individual work.
And is there a difference? Because there's so many mindfulness resources out there. Mm-hmm. You know, I guess the question is there a difference between why would someone choose just to go to a mindfulness teacher versus a psychologist or therapist that incorporates mindfulness into their therapy?
So, I mean, I can speak to it from my experience and kind of the way I use it. Mm-hmm. So I think that, as I said, kind of mindfulness is that awareness that, you know, people tend to take their mental and emotional events as literal truths, and not as part of the human experience where we all experience pain and we all experience suffering, et cetera. And I think that a mindfulness teacher might be able to teach you how to notice those mental events, notice those internal experiences, and kind of teach you some of the skills of mindfulness, whereas a psychologist would be able to do that and also integrate that into the broader case conceptualization of what your diagnosis might be or how different things in your life might connect in a way where mindfulness might be beneficial. So for example, mindfulness, a lot of the times, because it is so present focused, here and now, what are you experiencing in this current moment? You might be able to learn that skill from a mindfulness coach or sometimes they're called like heart teachers, that to bring awareness into your current experience. Whereas a psychologist might be able to say, to connect it to avoidance and something that you learned in childhood and the way that a parent maybe taught you to disconnect from your emotions in a certain way or taught you to internalize self-judgment or to listen to those kind of internal criticisms and take them as truths. And I think that the psychologist approach to it could just be a little bit broader. That doesn't mean that there aren't wonderful mindfulness teachers out there or that there's not tons of benefit to it. I just think that getting it from a psychologist means integrating it into the bigger whole, a kind of a more holistic approach. And the other thing about it is, you know, the S in MBSR obviously stands for stress. And I think that, you know, the Western medical system is really good at addressing health-related issues like infectious diseases. And, you know, over 100 years ago, those were the things that killed most people. And the Western medical system has pretty much eradicated or can treat and cure those issues. And now stress is a mediator for the top 10 diseases that kill people, strokes and heart attacks and pulmonary diseases and even cancers. And so learning how to heal from within using mindfulness to kind of trust the wisdom of your own body is a really beneficial path to healing. And because this has MBSR specifically was kind of bred out of a medical center and bred out of a medical research on chronic pain, I think psychologists are well positioned to be trained in those facilities and be trained as part of medical systems. Again, not that mindfulness coaches might not be, but in terms of the holistic training that a lot of psychologists get, they're well positioned to be in those facilities to have a more holistic approach and understanding to the benefits of mindfulness and using it to treat medical, mental, and emotional stress and illness in people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it seems like the type of person who would be drawn to something like MSBR or mindfulness would be someone who feels burdened by their level of anxiety.
Yeah. I think it's not about, and this is kind of one of those common misconceptions, is that anxiety, sadness, stress, I mean, all of this can be so overwhelming. And there's a whole list of things that mindfulness or MBSR can be used for, which I'm happy to kind of share. But I think that people look to interventions like mindfulness or MBSR as like a cure for anxiety or for addiction or for grief or for chronic pain or cirrhosis or, you know, any of these, not cirrhosis, sorry, psoriasis. Big difference.
Well, maybe cirrhosis too.
Probably would help with that. Yeah. People look for a quick fix, or people want a cure. And I think that this is a big misconception or myth about mindfulness, and that it's not about making you never feel sad again or never feel anxious again. It's about changing your relationship to those emotions, changing your relationship to those thoughts. And so often we're kind of in autopilot, and we don't realize the way that our nervous systems might be responding, or how we talk to ourselves in a hardship, or, you know, we just don't have full awareness of what our experiences are. And so we can get very easily hijacked. And one thing that mindfulness really seeks to create is a little bit of space. So if we think of like reacting versus responding, if we take anxiety, for example, someone feels anxious and they might reactively try to distract themselves or avoid it, or, you know, take a Xanax or drink a glass of wine or phone for anything that they might do to get rid of their anxiety or to move away from their anxiety. It's very reactive. But with mindfulness, we want to create a little space between the stimulus, the anxiety, and the way that we respond to it. And in that space, there's a little bit more freedom, a little bit more wiggle room, so that we can respond in a way that's a bit more skillful and perhaps a bit healthier and more adaptive. And maybe sometimes the thing that we need to do is to phone a friend or is to take our medication, but maybe sometimes the thing we need to do is just not instinctively react in a way that might feel good in the moment, but could actually make it feel worse down the road. And so mindfulness helps build that capacity to kind of make space, hold space for whatever the emotional experience is, whatever the bodily sensation is, whatever the thought pattern is. So we can kind of step out of maybe those ruminative patterns or those unhealthy, maladaptive ways of responding or reacting rather, and start responding in a way that's a bit more skillful.
Right. It's kind of the ability to build some resilience and to be able to sit with uncomfortable feelings.
Exactly. Exactly.
Which is really the foundation of many different types of therapies, right?
But totally.
Mindfulness gives you, yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
No, I was going to say I do a lot of ACT. I do a lot of EFT. And there are so many, CBT or even DBT skills. Like there are so many therapies now that are built on the foundational principles of mindfulness and these more kind of, you know, thousands and thousands of year old ancient, very wise traditions of healing that we've really built upon in our westernized systems.
Mm-hmm. Well, thinking about mindfulness and how it could really be helpful for so many different types of struggles and difficulties, is there anybody or any condition that it wouldn't be helpful for that you maybe would say mindfulness maybe isn't a great option for you?
You know, I was kind of thinking about this and trying to think back over research I've seen or literature I've read, and I haven't come across any that has been kind of a blanket statement of, you know, not good for this group of people. And I think the one thing, you know, I've seen it with kids, adults, elderly, you know, traumatic brain injury, Parkinson's, like I've seen it used with so many different populations. And I think the thing that I would caution people against, or maybe that I would personally be a little bit more hesitant about, would be one, if there is a specific scenario or a unique individual, you know, case by case basis. First of all, I think that some people just have negative responses. When you say like, oh, have you ever done mindfulness or practiced meditation? People really are prickle at that. And so when I see that, I usually will try to explore it a little bit and see what that's about. Of course, never pushing intervention on someone who's really resistant. But so that would be like one thing to me that I would be looking out for. Another is people who become so overwhelmed or flooded by their feelings that they might dissociate. That doesn't necessarily mean that I would never do mindfulness with them. I've certainly heard of mindfulness being used with dissociative identity disorder or, you know, people who have PTSD and dissociate as a result of that. But I might start differently. I might use more grounding practices initially. I might build more slowly, things like awareness of breath or awareness of sounds that are more concrete, rather than just kind of opening up the awareness to noticing thoughts or noticing feelings.
Could you just explain very quickly for the listener who maybe doesn't know what it means to dissociate?
Oh,
what that might look like?
Yeah, I'm trying to think if I can give, I feel like this is Charlene's wheelhouse, but basically it's kind of, it can look a couple different ways, but basically it's like an out of body experience. And people sometimes know that they're dissociating. They kind of get the feeling that they're like floating above themselves, or they're not quite in their body and they're looking down on themselves. And they feel kind of disconnected from their experience or from their reality or from themselves in a given moment. And then on the more extreme end of the spectrum, you have people who don't know they're dissociating, and it can kind of look like periods of like not remembering or just almost like blackouts. They're not unconscious and they're not, you know, necessarily under any sort of influence of a substance, but it has a similar look and feel to a blackout where someone just is so disconnected that they literally have no idea who they are, where they are, what's going on, or what their current experience is. And then when they come back into themselves, they have no recollection or memory of what just happened.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah. So you can really run the spectrum. So for those people, again, I would take this on a case by case basis. If it's someone who's so severe that they can't even hear me when I'm talking to them and guiding them through a mindfulness practice, you know, I might not want to start with the most challenging or most kind of nebulous practice. I might start with something really concrete, just like feeling the experience of your feet on the floor. Or something really grounding, really concrete, and then potentially build. And then I would also say people who maybe wouldn't benefit or that I would be cautious about would be people who have like very severe unresolved trauma, very severe depression or anxiety, people who are highly suicidal. If any of those kind of categories of people have been untreated or have never tried mindfulness, I wouldn't necessarily, again, kind of blanket say that mindfulness is not good for them ever, but I would be cautious about how and when I started with them. Because if you remember, the point of mindfulness is just to notice and to be aware. And if the experience that you're noticing or aware of is so painful or so overwhelming that it's unbearable, you know, I would encourage that person to begin using mindfulness either in conjunction with therapy rather than just on their own through an app, or to try it in their therapist's office rather than on their own. And I also would just add, no matter who the person is or what their experience is, I always encourage people to take care of themselves during a mindfulness practice. So that might mean if you're afraid that you're going to have a flashback or you're going to be so overwhelmed, maybe don't close your eyes all the way. Just lower your gaze to the floor. Or if you do close your eyes, but you feel really overwhelmed, open your eyes during a practice. You can return to focus on the breath. And also just making sure that people kind of have an arsenal of coping skills, concrete coping skills that they can use if they become so dysregulated or so overwhelmed during or after a practice, that it starts to become, that they become dysregulated or it starts to inhibit functioning.
Mm-hmm. And in a general therapy session that you might do with a patient, I assume you start with a mindfulness, tool or practice, right? And that allows, you know, the client to ground themselves to then kind of push into more of just to become more self-aware to like move more into the therapeutic process throughout the session.
Yeah. So if I'm doing a more formal approach with someone, then yes, I do it at the beginning of the session. And I'm not sure if I said this before, but I would also assign them or ask them to practice at home between sessions. If you do mindfulness one time a week for 20 minutes, you're not going to have no benefit, but you're not going to have the same benefit as if you do it at home every day for 20 minutes. Again, it's that dosing effect. Like if you take one antibiotic pill, it's not going to help you. But if you take the full course, then the infection's gone. It's kind of the same approach with mindfulness. So if I'm doing a more formal integration of mindfulness into therapy, yes. If I do it less formally, either because the client doesn't seem as interested or as willing, or maybe I think it could be too overwhelming for the client and I want them to build some skills first, it might just look like asking a client to slow down. Tell me what they're noticing in a moment. What are you thinking as we talk about this? What are you noticing in your body as we touch into this painful memory? What is your emotional temperature as you're experiencing this in the room with me, as we're discussing this challenging thing? So it can really look less formal for clients too. And I would also say that another way that I use it in therapy is my own mindfulness practice has come in really handy as a clinician. Just over the years, I've developed my own practice and it helps me really kind of tune into my own experience of a client during a session, and helps me slow down and helps me be in touch with what's going on with my body and my nervous system and my own awareness. And how can I use this information to guide treatment to help the client move forward in some way? Or if I notice that I'm really getting worked up because a client's getting worked up, I can do what's called co-regulating, which is if I regulate my own nervous system, I can kind of help pull them into a more regulated, deactivated state as well. So my own mindfulness practice, even if I'm not doing mindfulness with a client per se, has been a huge part of my clinical work.
Hmm. I'm a little bit of a change of subject. Sure. Just kind of thinking about mindfulness. Some people really grab onto it. And really, right, say, yes, I'm going to practice it. I'm going to do it every day. And they derive a lot of benefit from it. Other people just cannot get into it.
Yes.
I don't know. What do you have to say about that?
I have lots of thoughts about that. Well, I think that, I think that there are some people, everyone has a different reaction to things. And I think that there are some people who just don't take to it or don't find the benefit from it. And like I said, not going to push it on anyone. I mean, it's kind of like hypnosis. If you don't believe you can be hypnotized, you're never going to be hypnotized, you know? So there is a little bit of like a self-fulfilling prophecy. But I think kind of the biggest challenges that I've seen for people is I think one, people are really, really, really in the habit of trying to get away from their pain. I think people really don't want to sit with their experiences. They don't want to notice their experience. Why would they want to notice something that feels terrible? I often remind people the goal of mindfulness is not to like your experience. It's just to notice your experience. And I think people get really caught up in that wanting to avoid, and that mindfulness is kind of the opposite of avoidance, but actually being intentionally focusing on or being with. And I think there's a saying in mindfulness that it's simple, but it isn't easy. Because the idea of, oh, just noticing, just being aware is actually quite simple, but it's really not easy when what you're noticing is hard. So I think that's one thing. Two is people say they don't have time, but we always say, don't find time, make time, just like you would with any other important part of your routine, like going to the gym or making yourself dinner or taking a bubble bath or taking a shower, just any part of your daily routine. I would say find a time to kind of schedule it or build it in for yourself. So for example, some people do it in the morning. They like to start their day that way. I cannot do it in the morning. I fall back to sleep if I do. So I tend to do it after work because it's a nice way to like separate between my work and starting my home life, my evening after work. So finding a time that works for you, that's helps you be consistent, I think is also something that people struggle to overcome. I also think that this kind of speaks to some of the myths about mindfulness, which is that people expect that mindfulness equals relaxation and they're surprised or disappointed when they don't feel relaxed. But mindfulness and relaxation are two completely different things. If the point of mindfulness is just to notice and to be aware of your experience, and your experience is painful or uncomfortable or anxiety or sadness or grief or whatever, then of course you're not going to be relaxed when you spend time intentionally noticing that. And if you approach mindfulness with kind of that striving mentality that you're meant to get somewhere through mindfulness, you might feel disappointed or like it, quote unquote, isn't working. Because what you notice is unpleasant or you don't feel a certain way afterwards. And I think that people can get really activated when they're noticing these painful things, and they react to it or they judge it or they get really attached to the outcome of what the experience of mindfulness is. And that can be really disappointing or kind of a turnoff to people. And relaxation is certainly a lovely byproduct of mindfulness that can happen at times, but it's not the goal.
Right. And I was just kind of thinking about this idea of the listener thinking, okay, well, would I be better off just never noticing those things?
Mm-hmm. Well, my question would be, how's that working out for you?
Right.
Uh-huh. There's a couple different sayings or axioms that we have, which what we resist persists. And that which fires wires, both which mean if we push it away and push it away and push it away, it's not actually going away. We're just pushing it further and further down. It's almost like a wound that is infected. And the only way to get rid of the infection is to drain the wound. Otherwise it festers. And the energy that goes to keeping things under wraps or not paying attention or avoiding things often has more consequences and more negative effects on life and on health than just allowing yourself to feel and experience something. And I think, another saying is in any human life, pain is inevitable, but suffering is optional. This goes back to the whole idea that the point is not to make pain go away or to stop pain from happening in your life, because that is not living a human life. But can we help not exacerbate our own suffering by changing our relationship to our internal experiences? And instead of fighting against it, can we just allow for it and kind of the open flow of experience come and go, almost like clouds across the sky or waves in the ocean, without getting too caught up or attached to the struggle to get rid of pain, because that is what creates suffering.
I like that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. The last thing I just wanted to say about, because I think this is another thing that comes up for people when they think about mindfulness, is that they aren't good at it. And I think that this goes back to the, well, I don't feel better. I don't feel relaxed. I don't feel less anxious. So I'm not good at it. And I really challenge what that means. Because even if they have the thought, I'm not good at it, that too can just be a thought that they notice without getting too attached to it. And those kinds of self-judgments that people have can be just as, if not more toxic than any mental health or physical disease in the way that the stress of it manifests in the body. And so, you know, the wandering mind doesn't mean that you're bad at mindfulness. It just means that you're human, and noticing that your mind has wandered is the practice of mindfulness. And I think that self-judgment and kind of the harshness with which people hold themselves really keeps people from sticking with it as well. And people just don't really hold themselves with a lot of kindness or self-compassion. And so I think that kind of, again, that expectation of what mindfulness should be, or being successful at mindfulness, can make it really painful for people to stick with it for long enough to feel the benefits of it.
I was debating if we should talk about kind of current times, but it just seems so relevant at this point in terms of talking about pain and suffering, right? And I mean, I think a lot of people who are at home due to the quarantine are thinking about mindfulness because they finally have some time to commit to it, right? And yeah. I really appreciate this idea that this discussion of what is the point of mindfulness, right? And it's about tolerating and bringing things into your consciousness or allowing them to just kind of pass by and noticing them, and just a tool that someone could use to help relieve suffering without ignoring important stimuli that are coming in. Any thoughts, in terms of, how you've thought about this with the COVID crisis and the suffering and anxiety that people are experiencing currently?
Totally. Like I said, have a practice. I try to meditate every day. Doesn't always work that way. But again, try not to judge myself when that happens, because that's part of the practice too. It really looks different day to day. And I can only speak to my own experience and kind of what I do with my clients. So some days, for example, especially as a clinician who's talking to people all day who have their own forms of suffering, particularly as it relates to the COVID crisis, there's a lot of holding of other people's emotions. And sometimes that can be a lot. And so some days for me, it's just doing a grounding practice. Okay, I feel really overwhelmed by a really distressing story I heard today, or I feel really moved by someone's grief that I felt today. And so I just am so caught up in the stories I'm telling myself about this or my own reactions to it that I just need to recenter my attention to right here and now. So maybe it's feeling my feet on the floor, feeling my body in the chair, coming into my breath, noticing what my breath feels like in this moment, and kind of using it to as a recentering to the here and now. Because it's so easy to go into the memories of how things were a month ago or a few months ago before this had happened, or what's going to happen 6 months from now, and is this going to happen again next flu season? I mean, it's so easy to not be. There's a saying in mindfulness, it's a bit crude, I hope you forgive me, if you have one foot in yesterday and 1 foot in tomorrow, you're pissing on today. And I always like that, because it makes it, it's kind of like you're straddling today without actually being in today. And so sometimes it is just that kind of grounding, recentering to the here and now practice. Other times I just feel like my emotional temperature is hot and I got a lot going on and I just need to hold space for myself. And so it's just, again, kind of sitting and allowing the emotions to rise and fall and noticing, okay, today I feel grief, today I feel frustration, today I feel worry, today I feel sadness, whatever it is, and just not fighting against it, just allowing it all to be there. And, you know, you got to feel it to heal it, as they say. And then one thing that I've actually been integrating a lot of into my mindfulness practice the past couple weeks is self-compassion. And there's a whole other subset of mindfulness called mindful self-compassion. But really holding one's self with a bit more kindness and tenderness. And whether it's, you know, walking a client who's struggling and beating themselves up for how they're reacting to the situation, or my own just feeling like, wow, as a clinician, I'm hearing a lot and it's heavy and I just need to hold myself with a little bit of compassion right now. And you know, whatever it is, those are kind of the three iterations of mindfulness that I have been either practicing for myself or kind of with my clients, as this crisis continues to unfold. And I would also say that I think people get intimidated by mindfulness, especially now. You know, there's so many articles out about like how to make the most of your quarantine, or, you know, and we live in such a, we live in a culture that's very, doing based. We call it, like in mindfulness, we call it the doing mind or the doing self, where we're so busy doing, and mindfulness really tries to cultivate the being mind or the being self. And all of these messages about like how to Marie Kondo your home during COVID, or how to become a top chef, or how to learn a new language, or it's all that doing mind. It's the productivity, accomplishment, busybody, keep yourself moving mentality that's very ingrained in our culture and somehow makes us feel like we're failing if we're not constantly striving. And I think mindfulness can be really good at cultivating the being rather than the doing. And I would say, I think people are intimidated by building a mindfulness practice at this time for those reasons, but mindfulness doesn't always have to be formal. It can be very informal. It can be feeling the sudsy water on your hands when you're washing the dishes, or washing the grocery store germs off your hands, or it can be brushing your teeth, or you know, the way it feels to pet your dog or to pet your cat, or, you know, the way your feet feel in a pair of warm socks. It doesn't have to be this kind of formal 20 minutes of sitting in silence a day. It can really be a little bit more about just bringing your full intentional awareness to anything, or talking to a loved one. You can have a mindful conversation. You know, any of these more informal ways to integrate mindfulness into your life can be really beneficial as well.
Yeah. Any resources that you like that are out there? Or I guess I know it's kind of dependent on the person and their needs, but is there anything that you particularly gravitate towards that are online resources?
Yeah. So there's a couple apps that I use. My favorite is called Insight Timer. That is one that I have noticed has the biggest library of free resources. And if you go into they have like a categories tab. They actually have a tab just for MBSR. So they have a ton of other ones. They have relaxation ones and sleep meditations, et cetera, et cetera. But they do have a specific MBSR tab, which is nice. And then there's also good ones like Headspace or Calm are apps that people use the most. But Insight Timer is my favorite. And then as far as like places to go, they're all closed now, of course. But Insight LA and a place called Against the Stream, both are great resources. Inside LA has a few different locations. Against the Stream is in Venice, I believe. And right now, both of them have, I believe, are streaming a lot of practices and their mindfulness talks online. So even if they're closed, you can still access their resources. And then in terms of books, Mindfulness for Beginners by Jon Kabat-Zinn is a great place to start. Full Catastrophe Living is one of his more famous books that MBSR is kind of, I don't know if it's based off of, or it just was kind of part of the development of MBSR. Anything by Jack Kornfield. He's like a very wise mindfulness teacher, Dharma teacher. And if you're a clinician and you want to learn more about mindfulness, my mindfulness teacher was Greg Serpa, and he and his academic partner, Dr. Christiana Wolf, wrote A Clinician's Guide to Teaching Mindfulness, which is a great way to just kind of learn the basic structure and tenets of MBSR if you want to start using that.
Great. I will be sure. Yeah, those are great resources. I'll add them to just the links that we have on our site. So when people listen to this, they can check out those links as well. I really appreciate all the info you gave about mindfulness and MBSR.
Yes, my pleasure.
I'm actually, as I'm sitting here, I'm listening to the rain on the rooftop and thinking about how that's just, you know, very peaceful and calming.
Mindfulness of sounds. Yes, very good. Yes, absolutely.
I mean, do you want to end by doing a really giving kind of the listeners a little glimpse into the type of mindfulness practice, you know, you might do?
Sure.
With a client?
I can do a quick grounding practice. You know, it's a, maybe you can do it as quickly as 2 to 3 minutes. You can draw it out. I'll do it. I can just do like a 2 to 3 minute one. And it's also a really good one that I've been giving people during the COVID crisis, because when you're super overwhelmed and kind of at a 10, it can really help bring you back down into the present moment. So let me just get myself set up here so I can do it along with everyone. So the invitation here is to sit with your feet flat on the floor and sitting up in a posture that feels alert and awake, but also invites some ease into the body. And allowing the eyes to close if that feels comfortable for you, or just softening the gaze to the floor if you prefer. And starting by bringing the awareness into the soles of the feet. Just noticing the points of contact between the feet and the floor. Any points of pressure or touch here. And noticing if any other sensations in the feet are present. Like perhaps the touch of socks or shoes, maybe temperature or moisture. Just noticing whatever there is to notice in the feet. And moving the awareness now up into the body, noticing perhaps the bottom in the chair or couch, wherever you might be seated. Noticing any points of contact here. And if the mind has wandered off, you've become distracted by any thoughts or feelings or sounds, that's not a problem. That's just what minds are designed to do. So gently noting that and bringing the awareness back into the body in the chair. And shifting the awareness again into the breath now. Not trying to change or control the breath in any way, simply just noticing the breath exactly as it is. Noticing each inhale and each exhale, perhaps a place in the body where you feel the breath the most, and allowing this just to be the anchor for your attention for a few moments. And again, if the mind has wandered, just noting that and bringing the attention back to the breath, to that anchor of your attention. And in these last few moments, resting in the breath and knowing that your breath is always with you, you can return to the breath as an anchor to the present moment at any time. And when you feel ready, perhaps inviting some gentle movement back into the body if you've been still. And taking the time you need to open your eyes. So that's just a quick little portable practice that really can be used anytime, anywhere. Noticing the feet, noticing the body, noticing the breath. These things that are always with you and can help you focus on the present moment, whatever's happening, and just kind of hone the awareness in that way.
Well, that was really great. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You're so welcome. And like I said, I mean, that was a pretty short practice. That was, you know, maybe 3-4 minutes, but you can do 10, 20, 30, whatever feels good to you.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I'm so much more enlightened about mindfulness. So take care.
Thanks. All right. Bye.
All right, bye.
This has been Mind Stories. With remote appointments in California and offices in downtown Los Angeles, Santa Monica, Hermosa Beach, Marina Del Rey, and Echo Park, Cal Psychiatry specializes in medication management, mood and anxiety disorders, alternative therapies, women's mental health, and more to help you get back to your true self. Visit us at calpsychiatry.com. Thank you for listening to Mind Stories, and don't forget to subscribe.